Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the Berlin Wall, construction of the wall, and the kind of the context, really, of the Cold War throughout the 1950s, all the way up to the building of the wall at the end of the summer of 1961. And the context is important, really, and I think this, you know, when you're studying this at school, it kind of gets glazed over that there's a much bigger picture happening here. And it's one, ironically, of kind of stabilisation of Cold War politics throughout the 1950s. 1950s is obviously quite a time of high Cold War tensions. But from the Berlin airlift to the end of the Korean War, there is a feeling that, you know, Soviet troops may well kind of replicate some sort of Korean War type conflict in Europe. And there's a genuine fear of a Soviet march westwards. The death of Stalin in 1953 and the end of the Korean War that year present opportunities for a reduction in tensions, stabilisation of relations, partly because you have the rise over the next 3 years of Khrushchev to the leader of the Soviet Union. And Khrushchev needed to be able to present himself as an alternative to Stalin, as a continuer of the legacy of Lenin, as opposed to Stalin. Not out of any sense of a rejection of Stalinism. He was quite involved in Stalin's major crimes, particularly in the Ukraine. But he was a useful ploy to present himself as a credible alternative. Following the secret speech in 1956, however, Khrushchev's reputation within the communist world is seriously undermined. You know, for everyone from the Balkan. New Balkan communist states through to the Chinese are outraged that he has publicly denounced Stalinism. And so Khrushchev needs to find ways to project kind of power and strength once again against the kind of the forces of capitalism. He needs to be seen to be this kind of belligerent figure once more on the world stage. And Berlin becomes, from about 1957 and 58 onwards, an ideal way of doing this. So, with Berlin, you know, once the capital of once united Germany, obviously it was divided by the four Allied powers in 1945, who had the Four Power Agreement over separate zones of Germany and separate zones of Berlin, which is deep within the what becomes East Germany after 1949. The kind of the immense sort of destruction of the war had wrought, particularly on the Soviet Union, really gave the Soviets at Potsdam almost a kind of a moral right, if you will, or a moral imperative, or at least a very strong argument that it had the right to rule over East Germany and East Berlin in a manner that it saw fit, particularly with regard to reparations and the, sort of the asset stripping of the East, which has a knock-on effect later on of creating a poor and impoverished East Germany that makes the West West Berlin and West Germany look very attractive. By the early 1950s, the land border between East Germany and West Germany was sealed because of migration across the border. And it meant that Berlin could become the only conduit for East Germans wanting to cross over into the West. In the 1950s, West Germany experiences its economic boom. It is General Lucius Clay who is the chief Allied commander in Berlin, and particularly also was during the Berlin airlift, argues that by by fostering an economic boom in West Germany, you make the notion of liberal democratic capitalism a particularly attractive one. And the battle to defeat communism, to keep communism at bay, isn't going to be won by tanks and bombers and nuclear weapons, particularly after 1948-49 when the Soviets gained the atomic bomb as well, but it's going to be won through hearts and minds by bringing the idea, winning the arguments economically, presenting to Germans the benefits of free market capitalism as opposed to communism. Not that they were unaware of these things. The problem that East Germany has always is it's a substantially smaller state, with just under 18 million people, that it could ill afford to lose. It had lots and lots of... It had the lion's share in many industries, particularly things like kind of car manufacturing, and the textiles industry had a huge chunk of those fell into the Soviet area. But again, a lot of this was dismantled and taken back to the Soviet Union as compensation. The experience of Stalinism was quickly proven to be extremely unpopular in East Germany. In 1953, long working hours, a curtailment of workers' rights, high prices, and oppressive police, an oppressive police state led to riots which were brutally put down by East German troops and by the Soviet Union, with a range of a round of arrests and executions thereafter. But it wasn't just the poverty and oppression of East Germany that was leading to this mass exodus through the border from East Germany through to the West, and then through East Berlin come Czechs, Hungarians and Poles. Anyone that could managed to make it that far was the possibility of crossing the border. So you get something of a brain drain from the Eastern Bloc in general, and other Eastern Bloc countries become particularly indignant with the East German authorities. But East German authorities have a problem, because under the Four Power Agreement there is free mobility between the various zones of Berlin. So even if you build a wall along the East German to West German border, you've still got this conduit in Berlin where East Germans can cross over into the West, and then once they're there can quickly be given citizenship and moved into West Germany if that's where they want to go. So it becomes this problem for the internal diplomacy of the Soviet bloc within Europe, these communist puppet governments began to become extremely aggrieved. And the losses of population in East Germany become unsustainable. So between 53 and 55, the border is closed and barbed wire is placed all the way along between East Germany and West Germany. And one of the claims that the Ulbricht government had was that they were trying to insulate the socialist fatherland of East Germany from the kind of the tainting of the capitalist world, and they were trying to stop people crossing in the other direction, you know, keeping the troublemakers out and all that sort of thing, which is obviously seen as palpable nonsense at the time. By 1961, a fifth, one in five of the East German population had migrated, which amounted to about 3.5 million people. So these problems were becoming a serious issue for Khrushchev. Not only had it been a running embarrassment for the East German government, but it was used as a great ideological stick to beat the communist world with, just to show, well, you know, if people are given a choice, they choose liberal democracy and free market capitalism every single time. Problematic position that he was in the late 1950s, following the secret speech and its somewhat backlash in places like China, the issue of Berlin becomes a good one to make a stand on. So in 1958, he made a speech that indicated that Soviet policy over Berlin was hardening and becoming more aggressive, and that the Soviets weren't simply willing to accept what they viewed as interference from the West in their zones. And he demands the withdrawal of all Western Allied forces from the city. He says, in essence, that if they don't... There was never really a peace treaty signed at the end of the Second World War, the equivalent of the Versailles peace treaty at the end of the First. So the Germany is still occupied, and the two aspects, the two sides of Germany, West and East Germany, never sign a formal peace treaty with the Allies. And the Soviets say, well, you know, unless the Western Allies withdraw from Berlin, we will simply conclude a separate peace treaty with East Germany, and we'll kind of leave you guys in the diplomatic mess that will result in. What we suggest is we have a unified and neutralized German state, and this can this hopefully Khrushchev thinks will fall under the sort of the aegis of the Soviet Union eventually, or will perhaps even become, you know, a useful ally in the end. However, Khrushchev became increasingly suspicious that, as Stalin had become, that a rearmed West Germany was about to be presented as a kind of a powerful and dangerous enemy once again to the Soviet Union. And the thing that he particularly feared was that the Americans would equip West Germany with nuclear weapons. And he repeated these demands between 1958 and 61 to Eisenhower and Kennedy at the various summits, culminating in the Vienna summit in 1961. The level of exodus by July 1961, in 1 month, 30,000 people cross over. And then in August, in the first week of August, just before the wall is put up, 21,000 people cross in 1 week, and there is a fear that kind of the state will collapse. Obviously, this isn't the first time that there had been this kind of intervention to try to.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cut off Berlin and to force the Allies out. The kind of the two Berlin crises, I guess, really are 48 to 49 and 1961. Though the 1961 crisis really is bubbling along for quite a long time. You've got at this period of time as well the kind of the development of, you know, rival defensive pacts in the guise of NATO and the Warsaw Pact. And so this, whilst the issue of Berlin is one that sort of chiefly threatens instability and nearly comes to the point of war, there is on both sides, due to kind of military build-ups, this kind of rather unlikely development of stability, and Berlin, the Berlin crisis, is the last piece in the puzzle. Within the Kennedy administration, two different views prevailed of what to do about Berlin. There was plenty of spirit of compromise. The State Department repeatedly briefed Kennedy that Berlin wasn't worth going to war over, and it was possible to compromise with the Soviets. Clay on the ground argued that as the wall started to go up, and we kind of get ahead of ourselves slightly here, but as the wall started to go up, he said, you know, if we just put a bulldozer on the front of a tank and go through it, we knock this damn thing down, the Soviets will back down. And subsequently, archival evidence suggests that perhaps that was an astute judgment, and that the Berlin Wall crisis could have been brought to an end at that point. The Berlin Wall may never have existed had Clay gone ahead. But Kennedy, at the same time as he decides that maybe there is room for compromise and intimates this to the Soviets, he also engages in a program of rearmament and of calling up National Guardsmen and increasing looks like the draft and that sort of thing. And so the Soviets have mixed messages, which is one of the kind of the key theme of the Cold War, particularly up until the Cuban Missile Crisis, this ambiguity behind what's really being intended. Khrushchev particularly comes whilst on holiday at the Black Sea resort of Sochi, becomes very, very angry when he hears that the Americans are rearming or increasing their level of defence spending, and perceives this as a threat. He believed when he met Kennedy at the Vienna summit in 1961 that he wasn't dealing with Eisenhower anymore, this, you know, battle-hardened general who had proved himself in the Second World War. He was dealing with a young lad, if you will, And he thought that he wanted to test Kennedy's resolve and see what Kennedy was made of, and later on tries again during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and believes that Kennedy can kind of be pushed around a little bit, that he's a sort of a lesser and inexperienced man. And he discovers that really Kennedy is quite the cold warrior and quite willing, when necessary, to draw a line in the sand and to be belligerent in response. Throughout 1961, the stockpiling of barbed wire, of fence posts, concrete, bricks and mortar and everything else you need to build a long wall around, really not around, you know, not between the two zones, but around West Berlin, was well known. Even West German companies, even British companies, were selling things like cement and mortar and barbed wire to East Germany. So no one was surprised, at least nobody in the military and defence circles of the West was surprised when the wall started to go up. It had been long understood that this was what was going to happen. And I think this piece of information is the really interesting bit, that the CIA, MI6 and various other agencies, various generals knew full well the Soviets were going to the East Germans with the Soviet help were going to build the wall. And perhaps encouraged it a little, or perhaps were unfazed when it occurred, and some actually viewed it as a reasonably positive development, because at least it meant that instability declined. You know, there may be the wall may have been very unpopular with the civilian populations and had divided families and, you know, terrible breaches of human rights. But as far as the generals were concerned, it meant that tensions would decline. And once stability had been resumed, then the risk of open conflicts declined. American intelligence had spies in the East German regime and knew a week before the building work began that the East German government was planning to create a wall. And so it came as no surprise. So at midnight on August the 12th, 1961, soldiers and police in East Berlin closed the borders with the Western Zone, and they set up barbed wire along a 156-kilometre border zone around West Berlin. The wall itself comes slightly later. But because Berlin is inside East Germany, and the Western Zone is seen by the East German government as a small island of anti-communism in a communist country, and this is the kind of the spiel that they have for the East German population. And they said, really, we've got to quarantine this, you know, troublesome, you know, still basically kind of quasi-fascist sort of city-state, if you will, from our socialist fatherland. 32,000 East German troops were used to build the wall, and the Soviet tank division was kept in the rear just to remind the East German people not to protest or to kick up a fuss, and maybe to intervene if the West decided that they were going to fight to prevent the wall from going up. Roads and courtyards and houses and gardens and public spaces that crossed between the zones were cut in half, and the windows that looked over the wall were bricked up to prevent communication between the two sides. Normal rights that American, British and French diplomats had to cross over into East Berlin were revoked, when tensions were raised on October 25th when the Americans drove tanks to the border between the East and West that hadn't been yet cut off by the concrete wall. The wall itself, when it's built, is built kind of a few hundred yards behind the barbed wire, and houses between the barbed wire and the wall are demolished. So you have this kind of no man's land, which is a very dangerous place to cross if you can be seen from a guard tower, which are erected along the walls. And there were, after 1989, when the wall came down, trials of guards and East German Stasi senior officers and politicians who had shot dead East Germans trying to cross over. So the Americans drove tanks to the border, and the Soviets responded, both, you know, Soviet tanks and Americans had live ammo and were placed next to one another across the border, pointing at one another. And if either were if they were attacked, it was possible that October 1961, that World War III could have broken out as a shooting war along the border at that point. So it's a very dangerous moment in the Cold War, a moment of key instability, and followed by this period of increased stability once the crisis dissipates. The standoff ends when both sides, the Soviets say, well, we'll withdraw 5 metres, and the Americans say, well, we'll roll our tanks back 5 metres, and it's quite sort of an absurd moment in the Cold War. These tank crews back away slowly and fortunately without a shot being fired. So the crossing over to the West had been a crime since 1957 anyway, and punished by a long prison sentence since the wall across along the border fence along the border between East and West was put up. But by the time the wall had been built, 2.8 million East Germans had crossed over anyway. East Berliners continued to make attempts to escape. Some people jumped out of windows onto mattresses. Some were helped over by other West Germans. Some people swam across the Titlow Canal, and there were families who were divided and didn't see each other until the wall came down in the 1980s. And the Stasi had to pour vast resources into policing the wall. There were various high-profile attempts, balloons, stolen aircraft, tunnelling people, trying to drive kind of cars and buses through the wall, and various schemes over the years of kind of great escape kind of style. But the real result of the war was a kind of, as I said, an uneasy stability thereafter. And it gave Western politicians and occasionally celebrities, and by the end of the 1980s, the likes of David Bowie and Bruce Springsteen have observations in their music on the Berlin Wall. The last concert to be played in Berlin as the wall was coming down was Pink Floyd's The Wall. You can see what they did there. And it becomes this immense political and cultural kind of focus point and becomes a kind of, unfortunately for the communist bloc, a clearly indicative symbol of the Cold War and a symbol of the supposedly the moral and liberal superiority of the West. And by the 1980s, it was the likes of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher used it really as a kind of a leverage on Gorbachev during the perestroika era. Reagan famously sort of shouts, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Really, the Berlin Wall itself is kind of probably quite a peripheral issue in the Cold War, though because it is there in bricks and mortar, it's very easily dragged centre stage to help make any anti-communist argument with. So that was the Berlin Wall. I'm going to come back a little bit more to Germany in the 1960s later on. I'm kind of keen to talk a little about Germany in 1968. I talked about that a while back when I talked about the Bader-Meinhof gang. But there's more to be said on the German student movement, I think. So that's a story for another time anyway. So the new Explaining History recording studio is almost built, and so we should be resuming normal services soon. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.